my bags packed, I'm on a roll. I'm heading out there, and I'm ready to go.
Amateur Traveler, episode 122. Today the Amateur Traveler goes to Barcelona, Spain. Learn about the architecture, a chocolate museum, and where you can find a good paella. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. I have two news stories for you today before we get into the interview on Barcelona. The first one is that in 2007, for the very first time in the United States, more travel was purchased by dollar amount through the internet than offline. It's surprising that it took us that long to get to that point when I consider how long we've been booking online, but obviously there are many people who are not comfortable purchasing anything on the web. But since it's so much easier in many cases to purchase on the web, we finally crossed that barrier. The second news story is a little more in-depth. If you're interested, there is a new company forming called Traveler 2.0. Traveler 2.0 is looking for people to take a year-long journey around the world on them. They're looking for 30 travelers who will be willing to write about places they go to, do research for a new travel site, and join a new Web 2.0 travel startup company. I had a chance to talk to the founder of Traveler 2.0, Ryan Flynn, who is also the founder of the White Orchid Foundation, which is a foundation for the last 10 years has been trying to rescue kids from the sex industry in Southeast Asia. And Ryan is now forming this for-profit company in part to help support that non-profit, non-governmental agency. So 40% of the profits from this company will go to the White Orchid Foundation. If you're interested in that, or if you're just interested in the White Orchid Foundation, check out the links to all of these stories on the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. I'd like to welcome to the show Tom Merritt from the Buzz Out Loud podcast, and Tom has come to talk to us about a recent trip to Barcelona. Tom, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Chris. It's great to be on here.
So why Barcelona? First of all, what led you to that lovely spot of Spain?
Interestingly, we started by wanting to go to the Rugby World Cup in France in October and ended up going to Barcelona in November. And the way that happened, we were using points. We were using frequent flyer miles for the plane trip, and we were using hotel stay points for the hotel. And so nothing really matched up in October with the game that we would have been able to go to, or the places we were going to be able to stay, or the flights that we could get to. So my wife had been wanting to go to Italy for a long time. So we started to look at Italy and tried to figure that out, and just nothing. That was even worse. Like, we couldn't get a flight into Italy. So finally, we got a little frustrated and said, well, where can we go, to the folks in the frequent flyer department? And they suggested a couple of places. One of them was Barcelona. We'd had lots of friends who had gone to Barcelona and said they had a great time. So we're like, great. You know what? This has been on our list, maybe a little lower down. Let's give it a shot. So all the stars aligned. We were able to get a flight into London and then a cheap connecting flight to Barcelona. And we got our hotel stay, no problem, on La Rambla in the central part of Barcelona. Mm-hmm. And really glad that serendipity led us that way, because we had an excellent time.
Let's jump right in. What was the highlight of Barcelona for you?
The ham. Seriously, the food, the coffee, the café con leche, the jamón sandwiches, the anchovies, the cava. I mean, we just totally ate our way through Barcelona. And we've been obsessed with trying to find places like that in Oakland since. And we actually found one, a place that has – it's Serrano ham, not jamón ibérico, which is what we had in Barcelona. Mm-hmm. But it's close, and they serve café con leche that's kind of like the stuff that we had there. But that was really the highlight, was exploring real tapas. I never understood the whole tapas thing here in California until I went to Barcelona and I realized, oh, this is how you're supposed to do it. Some small sandwiches, some anchovies with some bread with tomato, a plate full of meat. And it all worked together. I think probably one of our favorite places was the Champonette place we went to, and you just stood at the bar and you picked out your foods, your stuffed peppers and your anchovies and your ham. And then they would serve you a little thing of cava, which is sort of a local champagne-like drink. And real friendly folks and just a blast.
You didn't go to the Museo de Jamón then?
No. Is there one? Really?
Well, yes, but it's the name of a delicatessen.
We went to the Museum of Chocolate, actually.
Well, there you go.
That was a lot of fun. In fact, we have a few pictures of some of the chocolate. There's a chocolate Salvador Dali painting in there, and they have like chocolate things of bullfights. And then you go through the history of how chocolate was discovered and how it was made and when it was brought to Spain and all of these dioramas made of chocolate. And then at the very end, of course, they have a gift shop and a cafe, and you can order what is actually a fairly common thing to get in Barcelona, which is a cup of real chocolate. We're not talking about hot chocolate here. This is like dripping, melted, dark chocolate. And then you can also buy churros to dip in it if you want. And it was the best cup of melted chocolate I've ever had in my life.
I don't remember having that in Barcelona. In Madrid, when they serve you a hot chocolate, it's basically pudding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty much the same thing. Okay, I think we're talking about the same thing for sure.
Yeah, you can't actually drink it, but it is wonderful with your churro.
They give you a spoon to drink it with.
And where did you stay? You say you stayed on Las Ramblas.
We had Starwood points, which is like the Westin chain. So we stayed at Le Meridien, right at the very tip-top of La Rambla, near Plaza Catalunya, which is sort of at the opposite end from the Mediterranean.
Right.
And we were very glad we stayed there once the Glasgow Rangers fans came to town. The Rangers were playing Barcelona's FC Barcelona soccer team in the European Championships. And so we came out of our hotel one day, and there's just people in blue soccer jerseys everywhere. And some of them are behaving themselves, and some of them aren't. And we were able, because of our position there at the top La Rambla, to get away from them very easily into other quarters, like up Passage de Gracia and over that into some other areas to find places to eat and sort of escape the Rangers. They were there for 2 days. They lost. They went away. That's probably, next to the food, the second most remarkable thing about my trip.
If we want to give somebody a broad overview of Barcelona and the parts that you saw while you were there, do you want to give us an overview?
We stayed pretty much on foot. Okay. The only time we left our little area was to go up to La Sagrada Familia, which is the huge cathedral that has been being built for over 100 years. And it was Gaudí, who is the most famous architect in all of
Antonio
Barcelona.
Gaudí.
Like extremely famous architect outside of Barcelona as well. That's his big project. So we went there. That's a little bit north of the central area.
Right.
And then the rest of the time, we stayed kind of around in the neighborhoods around La Rambla. La Rambla goes from the Mediterranean up through the central part of the old area of Barcelona. There's the Gothic area where you wind through these little tiny streets that have been there since the Middle Ages or before. We did one day where we kind of looked for the Roman remains from the Roman settlement of Barcelona, found the wall. It's built into a cathedral that was later built. We searched for the Temple of Caesar, the Forum, and couldn't find it. We ended up realizing we had the map backwards later on, and so we were going away from it the whole time we thought we were going towards it. We spent a lot of time in the Barrio Gothique, that Gothic area. Mm-hmm. We spent a lot of time in those neighborhoods right off La Rambla. Walked down towards the water and towards some of the neighborhoods down there where they have sort of revitalized an area.
Right, since the Olympics.
The really hip hotel is apparently down there where all the famous people stay when they come to Barcelona. We did not get up to the castle in the Montjuïc area, where they have the Olympic Stadium, the Olympic Village, or any of that. But we did a lot of exploration in and around the central area. And we were there for 5 days, and we found plenty to look at just doing that.
When I look at your pictures, they look a lot like our pictures from Barcelona. Half of them, some architectural feature designed by Gaudí.
Yeah, we didn't know that much about Gaudí when we went, so we steeped ourselves in it. And of course, if anybody doesn't know, the term Gaudí actually is attributed to Antonin Gaudí, because his style was very gaudy. It was very much like throwing colors in and using natural forms and making things look really eerie and natural and colorful. And it was just a really cool experience to see all of these somewhat modern looking architecture, but realize they were from the early 1900s.
Right.
La Sagrada Familia itself is incredible, just because it's not done yet. I mean, the idea this cathedral has been being built for almost 100 years now is incredible. I mean, that's the kind of thing you read about when you read history texts about Chartres Cathedral in France and the way they used to do it in the Middle Ages. And this is it playing out. And they really are. Unless they hire people to just walk around with blowtorches and pretend to be welding things, they were really there working on it. When you were standing in line to go up the one tower that they let you go up, you could see the workmen carrying things around, carrying concrete around and welding things together. And then you go up the elevator and you get to the top and you can look down over the cathedral and over the city, of course. And when you look down into the cathedral, you see the parts that are still being put together.
Well, the thing that always amazed me when our expression of that is it didn't really look like they were building it. It looked from the style of architecture like they were growing it.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it, especially considering his use of the organic form. And he has the four facades that are all in a slightly different style. And I think the first one was started by someone else, because I believe the cathedral was started by another person, and that's the most traditional one. And then they get proceedingly more curvy and organic as you go from one to another. And you're right, it does seem to be just kind of slowly oozing up in this real Gaudi style that you have to see to really get a grip on it.
Well, and parts of it are bearing fruit. It looks like some of the towers.
Yeah. There's the apples and bananas or whatever those things are that are kind of falling off the cathedral. And then there's also Casa Batlló, which is a little easier to get a hold of because it's not so massive. It was an apartment, like a four or five story apartment that the tenant hired Gaudi to come in and remodel. And he did it in sort of a dragon aqua creature sort of style. So if you look at it from the outside, you can see the balconies sort of representing the teeth of the monster within. And when you go inside it, you see things on the walls that are like scales, and it's very blue, as if it's sort of an underwater creature that you're living inside of. This looks like it was grown as well, like this grew around the apartment that was there before.
And then the chimneys on the very roof look like sentinels that have been placed there. Just very interesting style. It sounds like you reacted to it the same way we did.
Yeah, it was a real blast to be able to walk around it too. Casa Batlló, you actually had more freedom than at La Sagrada Familia because it's not under construction. And they've opened up another floor recently so that you can get a little more sense of what it was like to live in that area. And yeah, you go up on that rooftop and you've got a nice view of the city, and you have these strange, again, like almost fruit-bearing looking things up on the top guarding the area. It's pretty fascinating.
And then you also got up to the park that he designed.
We did. We went up to the park, and very crowded.
And did you want to try your pronunciation at the park? I'm going to say Guiel.
I think we kept calling it Guel, Park Guel. We had enough caveman Spanish to get around, so people knew what we were trying to say, even if we weren't saying it correctly. But yeah, that was probably the biggest trek we took. La Sagrada Familia is right next to a train stop. And I have to say, like, it's actually very easy to get around Barcelona. The trains are easy to navigate. There's plenty of cabs around. The cab system is one cab company, and they're really easy to see because they're black and yellow. And then we took a train up to Park Güell. I think we took it from La Sagrada Familia. And it was a little bit more of a hike because it's not right near the train stop. But it was worth it. It was pretty crowded. But you get to see the little dragon guy. I can't remember what they called him. But you'll see him in person at Park Güell. And then you'll see him in keychain form all around the city because he's sort of the unofficial mascot of Barcelona. But it's essentially a dragon made out of mosaic that's kind of at the entrance to the park. And then you go in and there's lots of pillars that look like trees holding up this area underneath a plaza. And then you walk up and you can walk out on that plaza. And there's more of that mosaic kind of decor around. Mm-hmm. And the idea, I think, was this was supposed to be an estate, like a private park that they were going to build a small community on. And they never really got finished with that as a community and was eventually donated to the city as a public park.
What guidebook or resources were you using to navigate the city or to figure out what you wanted to see?
We hit on a little triumvirate of guidebooks that we would plan every morning. And this was essentially our routine. We would wake up 10, 10-ish in the morning, lay out that guidebook and kind of decide what we were going to hit, go out and grab some breakfast, see a few things, come back maybe 4 or 5, take a nap, take a bath, get the guidebooks out again, hit those, decide we're going to eat, and then head out around 8 or 9 for what is there, an early dinner. Because
I was going to say, it's still a little early.
Yeah, the restaurants don't even open in some cases till 9, and 10 seems to be sort of the general, the prime time for dining out. So we actually try to hit it early because that way we'd be able to get a seat. But the three guidebooks that we used were the National Geographic guidebook for Barcelona, which was really good for finding the history, right?
Uh-huh.
That was what we used to kind of guide our tour of trying to find the Roman ruins, and just really good at explaining what all these things were that we were going to. Then we had the Lonely Planet Barcelona that our friend Chris Pavey from CNET had loaned to us. That was just good for finding restaurants, finding out where stuff was, getting some recommendations, because Lonely Planet usually has guided us well in the past. And then we had another Lonely Planet mini guide to Barcelona, which had some different information because it was published a year later. So it supplemented the other bigger Lonely Planet, but it also had these great fold-out maps.
Okay.
So I could stick that in my back pocket. I don't have to worry about looking like such a tourist. Just kind of pull that out, grab the map for the neighborhood we were in, and that was the one that I would take with me when we went.
Although they do say you look less like a tourist if you turn the map right side up.
Yeah, well, you live and learn, right?
And what did you find that they recommended that you wouldn't recommend?
That's a good question. I can't think of anywhere where they seriously steered us wrong. We were lucky in that respect. We never hit on a dud. I would say that we didn't take the restaurant recommendations in a couple of cases, and we were glad we didn't.
Okay.
There were a couple of restaurants that they said, this is kind of cheesy, or it used to be good, but it's gone downhill. But there was something we liked about it, so we went ahead and went. And I don't think we had a bad meal the whole time we were there. Probably the only restaurant that we didn't absolutely love was the one on the very last night we went to right across the street that was very touristy. It wasn't in any of the guidebooks. We just went to it because it was convenient, and we kept seeing it the whole time we were there. I don't remember how we decided on those restaurants, other than maybe hearing about them some other way, or there was a local channel that we were watching in the hotel on TV that might have recommended one of them for sure. We went to this kind of older restaurant, and I can't remember the district, but it's north of La Rambla, kind of northwest. It was walking distance, and it was kind of an old-fashioned seafood place. And we were like, we really want to get real seafood, not just anchovies, but like, you know, a real seafood. I ordered the salt cod that was prepared under a mountain of salt.
And interesting.
They brought the plate out after it had been cooked, but before they had prepared it, to show me, to prove that here it is. It is under the mountain of salt. And then they take it back, they debone it, take off all the salt, and bring it back out. That was delicious.
And do you remember the name of the restaurant?
It was in the Le Champlain, or L'Exemple in English, district, Casa Darío.
Okay.
A traditional Galician restaurant serves up a cornucopia gifts of the sea, is what they say. White jacketed waiters, that kind of service.
And then were there other things like that that you discovered that were either not recommended by the guidebooks, or just you learned from locals or stumbled across?
The first day we came out for breakfast, we had no idea we were going to grab breakfast, and we just walked out of the hotel down this really narrow old Gothic area lane, kind of overwhelmed by just being in a new place, and took a right turn. Right around the block was Buenos Migas.
Okay.
They had a big sandwich board sign outside front that said cafe con leche y pan dulce for, I don't know, like a couple of euros. We're like, yeah, that sounds great. So we got a big old cafe con leche and the sweet bread and sat down, and it was the best thing ever. So we're like, oh, we've made this great discovery. We found this little local place. Well, it turns out Buenos Migas is actually a chain. It's sort of like a Pete's level type of thing.
Okay.
We saw them elsewhere across Barcelona. So I don't know. Pete's is a great coffee chain in California. So maybe I haven't found out yet what the locals actually think of the Buenos Migas chain. But it always seemed to have people in it.
Okay. What was the biggest surprise?
One surprise. Well, the Glasgow Rangers were obviously the biggest surprise.
How about the biggest positive surprise?
A couple thousand Scots with their beers in the streets was not exactly what we were planning on. But no, I know what you're getting at. I was not surprised so much that people spoke English as much as they do. I mean, you kind of realize that that's going to happen, especially because of the UK proximity. People speak a lot of English. People speak a lot of French in Barcelona as well, because you're very close to France. So I had some people try French on me a couple times, and I was like, I was surprised at how well we were able to get around with the Spanish. Simply, you know, we don't speak Spanish fluently. We knew enough, and people were always willing to let you try. And it wasn't like I've had experience in some other countries where they just talk to you in English and don't want to mess with it or give you some sort of attitude about even trying. As long as you were speaking in Spanish, they would speak Spanish back to you. And the people I met were very patient in listening to it. And in one case, near La Sagrada Familia, we found this little bocadillo shop, this little sandwich shop. And he was speaking Catalan to me, which is the local language in Barcelona because it's part of Catalonia. He was speaking Catalan. I was speaking Spanish. He was fine with that, especially my broken Spanish. But he was speaking Catalan right back and didn't budge, and we were able to communicate. So the way the language barrier played out was probably one of the biggest surprises to me. I knew there would be a way to communicate and all that. Maybe I was surprised a little bit at how well we were able to make ourselves understood, but also how patient people in Barcelona were, at least with us.
The one story that we had that emphasize that for me also in Barcelona is we were riding to the cab after we were leaving Barcelona to going to the airport, and the cab driver turns around and says to my wife, who doesn't speak Spanish, has never studied Spanish, but he says in what is perfect Spanish, but she didn't believe him, mucho tráfico. And she's thinking, you're just making it up. You're not even really speaking a foreign language at this point.
Yeah.
So I mean, sometimes it's really not that hard to figure out what's being said. It's not that strange a language from English to.
No, it's a Romance language. It shares a lot of the same roots as English. And especially if you live in an area like California or Texas or New Mexico,
right,
and you're around Spanish enough, or even some of the inner cities in the other parts of the country, you pick up a lot more than you realize. And you start to realize how much you've picked up when you get in these sort of situations.
Yeah. Any other highlights from Barcelona? If you go to Barcelona, don't forget to go to...
There's one that probably fits into what you were talking about with surprises. There was one place that we went to that I was really glad, and we even went back a couple times, El Corte Inglés, the huge department store. We went up and ate in the restaurant at the very top where you can look down over the plaza. And the day we did that was the day they had herded all of the Glasgow Rangers soccer fans into the Plaza Catalunya. So we were looking down on all of them safely herded into the plaza. And we had the lobster paella, which they out. Did you ever have that?
I did not.
They come out and they assemble it at your table. So they have the rice and everything all cooked, but then they have the lobster, and they split the lobster, and they take off the claws, and they pull out some of the meat. And so you get the claws still in the shell, but you get a lot of the other lobster meat already, and then they lay it out really nicely. And it's a lot of food, but it's really delicious. And it's at a department store. And then there's the whole department store. I mean, this is your old-fashioned end story. We have everything under the sun. You want to book a cruise. You want to buy – I don't know if you can buy an elephant like you can at Harrods, but it seems like, you know, they have a whole floor of electronics, whole floor of toys. It took me back to some of the department stores that I remember in St. Louis when I was a kid that you don't really see anymore. And then down in the basement, they have a grocery store, which is a fantastic place to do some grocery shopping. They have a great wine selection down there, all kinds of local chocolates and candies and breads. And we did actually a lot of souvenir shopping in El Corte Inglés to bring back, you know, snacks for people. It was at one point, actually, because we were such fans of the ham, we toyed around with bringing tinned Iberian ham. It was in a can, and it said that it needed refrigeration on it. And we're like, yeah. And even if it's in a can, if it says refrigeration on the can, then we probably wouldn't be able to make it last all the way back. So I was kind of disappointed with that. But otherwise, loved El Corte Inglés.
And the moment that you most thought, now this is what it must be like to be a resident of Barcelona?
Probably either riding on the train, because you didn't see a whole lot of other tourists on the trains, at least when we were there. So I kind of got a little flavor of the commuter lifestyle. Or just sitting in the cafe, because it seemed like there were a lot of folks that were from the neighborhood in a couple of the cafes we sat at, just watching the world go by, working on stuff. They had their laptops out or writing things, reading. And I was like, this seems to be what they do in Barcelona. You know, they have somewhat of a cafe society. It was a really young crowd in that area around La Rambla too. So you had a lot of artists and a lot of creative people, looked like people who were maybe novelists or writers. And it's a lot of creative energy.
And who would you recommend? You came back and you said to these people, you really got to go to Barcelona. And you said to these people, not so much you.
I know what you mean, because there's been other places where I'm like, yeah, you probably wouldn't have liked it. I would recommend it for almost anybody. I was more saying you probably want to stay up in Le Champlain instead of on La Rambla. La Rambla is a little more of a party place. Or you, the partier, the guy who likes to go out late every night, you want to stay down at the Mediterranean end of La Rambla. You want to stay where the stuff is happening. People are up all night. But there's definitely something for everybody in Barcelona. And I know that sounds like a tourist brochure. It sounds like the Chamber of Commerce of Barcelona. But so many people, unlike other places we've been, said the same thing before we went. They're like, you're going to love it. Barcelona is fantastic. Maybe if the people I would say not so much to, if you really want a luxury vacation where things are super easy and taken care of, Barcelona is a smaller town. So there's a little more DIY involved in getting around, but not that much. So if you want it to be super luxurious, maybe you need to stay where all the stars stay down by the Mediterranean, or maybe it's not for you. But it's not like you only can go as a backpacker. And the next time I go, I'd like to take some day trips.
At any particular place that you guys were planning on going but just didn't work into this trip?
The one place that we did plan on going was up into the Stade Olympique, I think is what it was called. The area where they had the Olympic Village. We went to Port Olympique. But the Montjuïc, Sens, and Poble Sec, that area we ended up not taking. There's a cable car. Not a cable car like in San Francisco. But a
gondola.
Gondola type things. Yeah, like that. That takes you up the side of the mountain up there. We were going to take one day and we didn't go. You know what we did do that I forgot though was the aquarium. We actually are fans of aquariums, so maybe this isn't for everybody, but they had an aquarium with all kinds of fish from tropical areas and Mediterranean fish and penguins, and that was a lot of fun.
Speaking of museums and those sort of things, did you do the Picasso Museum?
Yes, we did. I'm glad you reminded me of that. There was so much. It's hard to remember all of it. The Picasso Museum was fantastic, especially if you've seen Picasso stuff otherwise. If it's your introduction to Picasso, it's slightly disappointing because they don't have some of the more famous paintings. Those are either in Madrid or the Louvre or New York.
Right.
But if you've seen a few of those or even just know about them, you get the whole backstory. You see everything from his very beginnings and art that he worked on and all of the development. If you're wondering, like, how did this guy ever start drawing like that? You can see it in this museum. You can walk literally through his artistic life and see the development of that and understand what the blue period really is besides just having blue stuff on it. So I really did enjoy the Picasso Museum. They are – I hate to get buzz out loud on you, but they were a little bit crazy with the rights management. My wife was in the courtyard away from all the paintings and was just going to take a picture down in the courtyard, and they stopped her. Like, you're not allowed to take any pictures in here. So I found that a little annoying. It's like, you know what? We're really not going to take a picture of your courtyard and sell it on the internet and undermine your whole museum. But all right.
Any final comments if people go to Barcelona? One thing you would want them to know?
One thing we were worried about, and you may read about this, is the pickpockets. There's not a lot of crime in Barcelona, but the one crime that people do talk about is pickpockets. And all the advice we read was, don't look like a tourist. Don't wear big Bermuda shorts and hang a camera around your neck. And you know,
the Bermuda shorts are generally a good idea, except maybe in Bermuda. But
and so we followed that. You know, we tried to make sure that all of our valuables were in zippered pockets, so they weren't easy to grab at. When we were in crowds, we were kind of a little extra aware of who was around us. We didn't really hang much around our neck. Eileen did have her camera sort of at the ready, but she kept it secured, and we dressed nicely. That's one thing. In Barcelona, people are fairly fashionable. I was joking mm-hmm. with Veronica Belmont that they all look like Ryan Block from Engadget, which he took as a compliment. But they are. They're very fashionable. So you probably don't want to dress totally dumpy. You'll blend in. If you're going to pull out the map, sit down somewhere, maybe at a cafe to pull it out. Don't just like walk down the middle of the street. There are some homeless folks. There was one day where we were walking down one of those narrow streets and there was a guy yelling and screaming, and he saw me and he like lurched over to the side and came walking toward me yelling, and I just kind of stopped and didn't panic, and he lurched the other way and walked off down the street the other way. So it is a city when you're in that central area. So I would be aware of that before you go, but don't freak out about it. I mean, we weren't sure what to expect, and it turned out to be a kind of a non-issue. We took some fairly simple precautions and didn't have any problems.
Well, I appreciate you coming on the show and telling us a little bit about your trip. I know you preferred to actually talk about Oakland.
Well, you know, if you ever want to do
an
Oakland travel podcast, you know where to find me. Okay. In Oakland, actually.
Yeah.
We have great restaurants here. There's, you know, historic theaters and museums and all of that. So I don't know if there's a listener demand now that I've put it out there. You have to let me know.
I will let you know. I'll let you know. Thanks very much for coming on the show.
Hey, thanks, Chris. I appreciate it. It was really fun.
I already told Tom how much I appreciated him putting up with me. I was recovering from a flu as we recorded this, which is why I sound, at least to me, to be fairly low energy in this interview, and why I didn't get into my usual historical trivia there, things like Barcelona being founded, legend has it, by Hercules, or being named after Hamilcar Barca, who is the father of Hannibal, of elephant fame in the Second Punic War. But maybe next time we get to Barcelona, we'll talk about that kind of detail. But moving this show along, I have two internet resources for you today. The first one is handy if you're going to travel to Venice, unfortunately only if you're going to be traveling in the next 3-week kind of time window. VeniceHotel.org has a forecast for the crowds in Venice. So, for instance, here in the next 3 weeks would be Carnival in Venice. And so if you wanted to know when the peak of that would be, check out that resource at VeniceHotel.org. And the second one, if you're looking to avoid flight delays, especially in the United States, and why wouldn't you, there's a new site called avoiddelays.com. And when I posted an article to Tripinator.com on January 22nd, the number of flights delayed was 1,864, according to the FAA. But those flights are not evenly distributed across all flights. They tend to bunch at certain airports, certain times of the day, or certain flights. And this is a good resource for identifying which airports, which flights, which routes are prone to delays. And it would often be overcrowding in an airport or weather-related or whatever. The top 10 airports for flight delays are New York's LaGuardia, Newark Airport, Chicago's O'Hare, San Francisco, Philadelphia, Dallas, Miami, Greensboro, North Carolina for some reason, Houston, Texas, and then Burbank, California. Links to both of those articles on the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. In news from the community, I'd say Gary made my week when he pinged me from Yogyakarta, Indonesia. Gary is on a round-the-world trip, and I'll put a link to his travel blog that's documenting his trip. But it's always nice to hear somebody who is listening to the show while on the road. He had discovered the video version of the show and only recently discovered that there was an audio version of the show. And so on the last 2 weeks, he'd listened to 50 different episodes of the show. So there's got to be some sort of medal for that, possibly a Purple Heart. A while back, I got an email from Betsy, and Betsy wrote and said, "I finished your episode on women traveling alone and thoroughly enjoyed it. I, too, have been a solo traveler and found it both daunting and fantastic. On one trip, I drove into Czechoslovakia a few months after the Berlin Wall fell. Then, when trying to cross into Yugoslavia, the Austrian border guards persuaded me to have a look at Hungary instead because trouble was brewing in Yugoslavia. I finally visited the former Yugoslavia a few weeks ago, and what an experience. I found the new Bosnia to be full of bullet holes, not only in its buildings, but in its economy and its spirit as well. Croatia is much better off, but still a bit rough around the edges. I also listened to Cruising Alaska by Small Boat. Being a sailor whose cruise to Alaska expected to report from a really small boat, so I was a bit disappointed. But we've also cruised the French canals of Burgundy on a small 100-foot, three-stateroom barge, and highly recommend it. I looked forward to more cruising episodes, as we always game to jump on a boat. I find the less visited places are often far more interesting, though less comfortable, than London, Paris, or Munich. How about an episode on Bhutan, Nepal, or Jerusalem? I believe I have a guest lined up, actually, to talk about Nepal, not on Bhutan and not on Jerusalem at this time, but I'll keep looking. And I'll put a link to Betsy's blog also in the show notes. And with that, we'll draw this episode of The Amateur Traveler to a close. If you have any comments, feel free to leave them at the website, amateurtraveler.com, or send me an email, host@amateurtraveler.com. You can find many, many other ways to contact me at amateurtraveler.com/contact, including the phone number that you can dial in and leave a voicemail comments. And as always, thanks so much for listening.
I got to see one more cathedral.